Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
The sea is a sexy place, not just for human beach vacations, but for the billions of creatures who make homes and many, many babies there. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Given the remarkable diversity of aquatic life, think sponges, shrimp, and sharks, it's not surprising that animals have evolved such an astonishing array of ways to entice potential mates. And the less interference from human activity, the better. Mara J. Hart is research co-director for the nonprofit Future of Fish. Her new book is called Sex in the Sea, Our Intimate Connection with Sex-Changing Fish, Romantic Lobsters, Kinky Squid, and Other Salty Erotica of the Deep. Mara, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
Sex is interesting stuff, to be sure, but ocean creatures mating is not exactly a turn-on for humans. So what is the larger purpose in writing a book like this one for a general audience?
Sure. So the answer is really pretty simple, and one, though, that doesn't occur to most folks, which is that sex is at the heart of sustainability. So when we're thinking about all of the wonderful seafood that we enjoy from the sea, the amazing medicinal resources that we derive from marine life and the chemical compounds they can produce, even the shoreline protections that we get from things like oyster reefs and coral reefs, all of those things depend on the marine life being able to reproduce, having lots and lots of sex, and creating lots and lots of baby shrimp and oysters and fish that can support and create those reefs and all those products that we then enjoy. So sex is really what drives the abundance and the bounty that we rely upon, and it's also what drives diversity. So when the sperm from one individual meets with the egg from another individual, a whole new genetic blueprint is formed. And that's what drives all of the wonderful resources that we rely on from the sea.
And if anyone listening has an IVF baby or was an IVF baby, we're far enough along in history that this could be true, they have sea urchins to thank.
That's right. So sea urchins are one of the model organisms where we first started to understand how a sperm actually penetrates an egg, how fertilization really happens. And this is because they have relatively big sperm and eggs. So you can see them under a fairly low-powered microscope. They are very easy to keep in aquaria, so they're good lab specimens, and they have absolutely enormous numbers of sperm and eggs. So a single male sea urchin will release about 10 to 100 billion sperm in one puff, which is, compared to humans, we're at about 100 million. So we're looking at orders of magnitude more. And they puff them out through holes in the tops of their heads. So they sort of look like these pin cushions that crawl along the seafloor. And when they erupt, it's like a little volcano of sperm or eggs that puff out the top. So it's easy to collect and has led to some wonderful discoveries for our ability to really understand what's happening right at the battle of the sexes at that smallest level between sperm and egg.
The ocean is a gigantic place. So what are some of the ways that any two creatures of the same species even find each other if they're not necessarily together when they're feeling amorous?
It's a great question. It's a lot of real estate to cover. So the oceans are about 99% of the livable habitat on the planet. So it really is a lot of blue. And the strategies depend on the types of species. So you'll have animals that are large, like whales, that can produce sound. And sound travels very, very well in the water. It travels much farther and louder than it does through air. And we see species such as blue whales using this to communicate across huge distances, thousands and thousands of miles. And researchers have put hydrophones in the water, and they can now tell that a whale off of New England may be communicating with a whale down in the Caribbean off of Bermuda. So it really is an effective way for them to know who else is out there. But we've also noticed that there are some interesting things happening with blue whales in particular, where over the last few years, they have actually started to drop the pitch of their songs. The males sing these more complex songs, and they've been getting lower and lower and lower. I can't do a good deep baritone on the radio, but these blue whales can. And the researchers were trying to figure out, you know, why would they be all dropping their pitch over the last, you know, decade or so? And it turns out the theory that we've landed on so far is that blue whales were very much overhunted back in the 20th century. They were down to about, you know, 5 to 10% of their original population. So during the, you know, 60s and 70s, a blue whale trying to find a mate, that male really just was trying to find anybody out there, and he was calling as loudly as possible. And that happened at one pitch where the volume could really be nice and loud. But as the whales have recovered, which is great, due to the moratorium on whaling, the whales are starting to bounce back. These males are now probably not only having to use song to find a mate, but also to seduce their mate. And we know that across the animal kingdom, deeper voices tend to be more attractive to females. And this works for koalas to even us still. So the researchers think that right now the whales have dropped their tone because it's a way for them to show off their size. The bigger you are, the lower the tone that you can make. And if you're really big, you can make a low and loud tone. So these big blue whale males are probably out there singing deep. And I call this the Barry White effect. They're trying to learn those females by dropping their songs. So that's one way. Sound is a very popular way that fish and whales will use that tactic. Other animals.
Well, let me jump in for just a second here, Maura, because I was fascinated to learn that in addition to singing these very low mating calls, male whales get together like boy band style and sing the same song simultaneously.
They do. So humpback whales are a great example of this. They gather at breeding grounds. So this is a little different than the blue whales that sort of wander the ocean looking for females. In humpback whales, they all get together for a big romp in the summertime. And it's in the wintertime off of Hawaii. And the males are the only ones that sing in these complex elaborate patterns, and the songs can last for over half an hour. They're really quite wonderful. And in one region, the same song will be sung by the same males. And over the course of the season and then over the course of the year, they'll start to sort of elaborate and sort of improvise off of some of the basic notes. But yes, all the males will sing the same song. And we can see songs that are sort of transferred from one end of the ocean to another over time. So sort of the same way that our hit singles will be really popular here one year and then be picked up in Europe, say, and then maybe make it over to Asia, you know, and it's sort of this staggered bit of popularity. The same thing seems to happen with humpback whales, with many of the songs originating over in the Western Pacific and sort of working their way across towards us in the Eastern Pacific.
And do lady whales, do they respond with a song that says, "I'm on my way, babe," or do the males just keep singing and hoping somebody out there has heard them?
Well, this is one of the big mysteries. So especially in humpback whales, the females don't tend to sing. They do not sing. They can make noise, but they don't engage in these more elaborate, complex songs. And the strange thing that we see is when there's a lone male singing, the only thing he seems to be attracting are other males. So we're really not quite sure why this is and exactly what's going on. But we do also know that the males will form these groups, these sort of gangs, and they will chase the females in groups. And this may be a way, the singing may be a way of sort of helping to coordinate some of that activity. A female whale, if she is not willing, you know, you can imagine these whales can swim pretty fast. She could be hard to corral just one-on-one. And so the males do tend to form these groups and will often work together to try to get at least one male to be able to engage her. And that's in humpbacks.
And you don't have to draw us a picture here, but certain kinds of whales are just very, very large. And these are mammals, so they get together in a way that would be familiar to humans. We'll just leave it at that.
Yes.
It would seem like really disruptive to have these two enormous creatures in the ocean.
Whale mating is something that has rarely been seen, which is another really cool thing when you think about it. You know, we do a lot of whale watching, but yeah. There's only a few species that we've actually seen caught in the act, if you will. And it is definitely tricky. You're in a 3D environment, so even though it looks very similar, you know, they do have the male anatomy looks like, you know, human male anatomy. There's a large penis, and the females have a vagina that's an opening where the penis inserts. But getting that to all work when you don't have a hard surface to press against can be tricky.
So I guess they just they have it figured out.
Yeah, they've found different sort of approaches, and depending on whether it's dolphins or whales, they'll sort of roll and hold each other in different ways. And, you know, in the whale anatomy, the male's penis is made of a very sort of a fibroelastic substance, and it's extremely flexible, but also very durable. So they are quite adept at maneuvering themselves into position.
How do you get more barnacles if barnacles themselves are not going anywhere?
This is one of my favorites, and it's a great segue from conversations about whale penises. So whale penises, the blue whale, the largest on Earth, is about 12 feet long, and that's for about a 100-foot whale. So that's a ratio of about 1 to, you know, 10, 12. Now, in barnacles, the ratio's flipped. Barnacles are hermaphrodites, most of them, but they do not self-fertilize. So hermaphrodite, again, is when you have both female and male sexual reproductive parts. But barnacles, as you said, they can't move. And so they've developed these absolutely phenomenal phalluses that are very, very long. They reach a ratio of 8 to 1. So 8 times longer than the body length of the actual host of that organ. And they basically extend these long penises out into the tide pools, and they sort of blindly have to poke around, hoping to find another barnacle that's open and willing to let them reach in and share their male goods. And
that would seem really dangerous. Like that, you could end up waving
yes.
that thing where it wasn't wanted.
Yeah, absolutely. And I always think, you know, barnacles are pretty sharp, so it's got to be a little bit uncomfortable, I would imagine, kind of swooping around out there. There are dangers. Other animals that are similarly very well endowed, we know, often run into issues where their man parts do get clipped off in the line of duty. So we see this a lot with conch. Folks might be familiar. That's the big snail that's you see off of Key West and in the Gulf. And they have a very long penis, but the males often have it shortened by crabs and other animals that will literally clip it off to eat it. So it is a little bit dangerous. The longer penis is not always the best strategy. You have to be careful with how you're deploying it and making sure there aren't too many predators around and that you're quick.
My guest is Mara J. Hart. She's research co-director for the nonprofit Future of Fish and author of a new book called Sex in the Sea, Our Intimate Connection with Sex-Changing Fish, Romantic Lobsters, Kinky Squid, and Other Salty Erotica of the Deep. If you have a question, and I'm sure you have several at this point, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for the Doctor of Liberal Studies degree beginning in the fall of 2016. A customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
Down where it's wetter, take it from me. Up on the shore, they work all day. Out in the sun, they slave away. While they're devoting full time, floating under the sea.
That, of course, was Sebastian the Crab from the Disney film The Little Mermaid. We are speaking this hour with marine biologist Mara J. Hart, research co-director for the nonprofit Future of Fish and author of Sex in the Sea, Our Intimate Connection with Sex-Changing Fish, Romantic Lobsters, Kinky Squid, and Other Salty Erotica of the Deep. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or you can email think@kera.org. Okay, so there are these remarkable moments, I guess seasons, when everybody of a certain species decides to release eggs and sperm simultaneously. What cues are involved that it's time to go for it?
It's a wonderful question, and it depends on the species, but a very common cue is the moon. Mm-hmm. So many species will start to gather and group up around the full moons or new moons. And they do this because if you imagine, again, the sea is a very big place. So if you are releasing sperm and eggs into the water, you want to try to do it at the same time that other folks of your species are releasing their sperm and eggs into the water. And so to coordinate that, they often will use the moon. They'll use a water temperature, can also be a signal. And then often with many species, it's actually sperm. So we see this with things like sea urchins and abalone, where they will release a few males will sort of be a little bit eager and sort of go off first. And it seems that as that sperm goes off, it triggers maybe one or two other males, and then a whole bunch of males will start to go off. And then when it reaches sort of a critical level, the females sort of then think, oh, okay, I guess it's time. There's enough sperm up there. I'll now release my precious eggs, and hopefully there'll be enough sperm to fertilize them as they go. In other species, we'll see things like sunset is a major cue for corals. And corals are also hermaphrodites, so they're releasing tiny little bundles of sperm and egg. And they release them all at the same time across thousands and thousands and thousands of individuals across miles and miles of reefs. And it all happens at night, and it's all very precisely coordinated, not only with the moon phase, but with sunset. So different species will go off, and it's like clockwork. Some will go an hour after sunset. Another will follow 2 hours later. Some others 3 hours later. So it's this very precise timing in order to increase that chance that the sperm and eggs from the same species are going to mix across all of that blue sea.
And that timing by species is important in part because there can be some problems if two different species breed and you get a hybrid, which is like a coral mule.
That's right. So oftentimes when one species mixes with another, and you mentioned the mule, which is donkeys and horses getting together, it's a sterile offspring. So your genetic line, it's a dead end. And that's the opposite of what individuals want. It's what nature is programmed to continue to reproduce. So this timing becomes really critical because for corals, again, corals are like barnacles. They're stuck to the seafloor. They can't move. And they want to ensure that their sperm and eggs are mixing with the sperm and eggs of their same species to avoid that hybridization. And many corals are very closely related. And if you were, and we know this from wonderful lab experiments, Dr. Nicole Fogarty has been working on this for years, and they can show that if you do mix a sperm and an egg together from two different closely related coral species, they can fuse and will grow a coral hybrid, but that often that hybrid might not reproduce and might not be able to continue the line forward. So hybridization is definitely something most animals try to avoid. It's not something we tend to need to worry about. So we're internal fertilizers, right? So sperm is deposited inside the female. So it's highly unlikely a different species would sort of get in the way. But for these external fertilizers in the ocean, it really is a big problem that they are constantly working to solve.
Does this happen? Is it more likely to happen, Mara, when populations are strained? Maybe there aren't enough of the same species of creatures to partner with?
Sure. So hybridization can be an effect of that. And again, Nicole Fogarty has been working on some really interesting studies with some of the endangered Acropora corals that are in the Caribbean. So these are the elkhorn and staghorn corals. And what they found is these two species are very closely related. And in the past, they had extremely large thickets. So these corals look like trees underwater. They've large branches and they grow in forests on the seafloor. And in the past, these thickets were so big and thick that when the species spawned, there was so much egg and sperm of the right species all around that the eggs were fertilized almost right away, likely by the sperm of their species. But over time, these corals have suffered from climate change, from overgrowth, from seaweeds, which is a consequence of overfishing. And there are fewer of them, and they're spaced farther apart. And the odds of those eggs being fertilized right away by their own sperm from their own species has gone down. And we're starting to see more and more hybrids form, this cross between the elkhorn and the staghorn. And these hybrids are, again, this is very new research, but they do look like they can survive, and it does look like they can potentially reproduce. The problem is they may be actually taking over and outcompeting their parents. And we're not sure if down the road, if their grandchildren, for example, will be able to reproduce. So we're starting to now see this competition from the offspring that could actually start to make it even harder for the parents to keep producing the egg and sperm that made them in the first place. So it starts to get pretty complicated and pretty difficult to really anticipate what's going to happen. But it's a major change that we're starting to see, likely due to the reduced density of these species in the ocean.
And that reduced density is a result of human activity.
Yes, in the case of corals, it really is a 1-2 punch of overfishing and the growth of seaweeds, which smother corals, and climate change, which has warmed the waters and created much more bleaching events, ocean acidification stresses. And I guess it's a 1-2-3 punch because pollution's not helping either. So unfortunately, we've really hit these corals hard. And the other factor is that when you think about animals that cannot move very, very far, so again, corals can't move at all, but species such as abalone, which some folks might be familiar with from the West Coast, this is a mollusk, it's a snail that attaches to the seafloor. When they reproduce, the closeness of their neighbors is really important. So the closer they are together, the more likely those eggs are going to be fertilized. So with an abalone, when they're within 1 foot of each other, very, very high fertilization rates. They move only about 3 feet apart, and the fertilization rate absolutely tanks. So when we start to harvest these species, or we have put threats into the ocean that have reduced their numbers, it's not just that there are fewer of them, it's that they're spaced farther apart. And that spacing also impacts negatively their ability to have the sperm and egg meet and be fertilized.
All right, let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Nita on the line in Cedar Hill. Hi, Nita.
Hello, this is such a fascinating topic today, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, are there sexually transmitted diseases among sea life, and if so, how are particular species affected?
That is a fascinating question, and I have to say I am not certain. My hunch is that certainly among mammals, so sea lions and walrus and whales that reproduce like us, I would imagine that there are certainly parasites and potentially diseases that could be transferred from contact. But for the external fertilizers, again, the sex itself is sort of an out-of-body experience. So for them, I don't think that there is much that is transferred in terms of disease when we think of, you know, viruses and bacteria. But it's possible. I will have to look. There's a few people who I know I could ask, and I will look and I will make sure that I get back to you, Chris. I'll share that with you guys so you can post it on the website. Nita, that's a fantastic question, and I'm sorry that I don't have more information to provide.
All right. That was a great question. I'm curious about how female lobsters can restore their virginity again and again and again.
It is a fantastic trick. So female lobsters have a pouch underneath their tail, and that's where the sperm is stored. And when they molt, that pouch is discarded along with any leftover sperm with the old shell. So every time they grow a new shell, they grow a lovely new clean pouch that they then have to fill with sperm through mating. So this is the way that they can lose and regain their virginity.
It would seem like lobster sex could be super dangerous if you think about all the claws. And female lobsters are actually very physically vulnerable during mating.
This is true. So like we just described, the best time for the female to actually mate is right after she molts, because she has that new chamber and she's looking to fill it with sperm so that she can then fertilize as many of her egg batches as possible before she grows too big and has to molt again. For the males, it's a wonderful time to molt because they know that they are getting to fill an entire female's chamber with only their sperm. They don't have to share room with any prior matings and sperm from prior matings. But when a female molts, that shell is her armor. It's her strength. And she is a soft-bodied animal that can barely stand just after that molting happens. So she has to present herself to this rather aggressive, large-clawed individual male. And this is problematic. So what she does is rely on a time-tested love potion in the sea, and that is her pee. So what she does is for about a week before she feels, week to 10 days before she feels the molt is coming on, she will slowly and carefully approach a male's den. And again, these males are very aggressive. They're very defensive of their territories. And so she sort of creeps up to the den and will quickly spritz a dose of her urine into his entryway and into his face as quickly as she can. And they do this. Lobsters, wow. The lobster, the bladder is located right below the brain. And there's two small nozzles just under their eyeballs. And they're able to actually shoot the pee out from out from their face right in front for quite a big distance. And so she'll do this. She'll douse him with this pee potion for a few days in a row, and slowly that scent from her starts to take a hold, and it sort of puts him in this love trance where he becomes very gentle, he becomes calm, and he actually invites her into the shelter. So they will then cohabitate, living together. They'll hunt and kind of hang out for a couple more days. And then this wonderful process happens, and Dr. Yael Atema from Boston University was the first to study this and coin the term knighting. And it really does look like that. She will walk in front of the male, and they'll stand face to face, and they'll both douse each other with lots and lots of pee. It's a big golden shower. And then the male sort of puts his claws down into the sand and bows his head. She then sort of lifts herself up and will lift one of her large claws and tap him on one shoulder and then the other. And it's a signal that's basically saying, don't go anywhere. This is all about to happen right now. So she then will go to the back of the den and begin the molting process, which can take a little bit of a while. And the male basically will stroke her with his antennae. He sort of is very gentle. He'll guard over her. And when she shows that the shell is off and she's able to sort of stand, he very, very gently will walk behind her and lift her up. And he does this again by putting his big claws. So these are Maine lobsters, the ones with the big claws. He'll put his big claws down into the sand, embrace himself with his tail, and then use his smaller walking legs and form sort of a hammock. And he holds her up in this hammock off the seafloor and rolls her onto her back. So they're now belly to belly. And it's basically the missionary position. And he inserts his two, it's actually two halves of a tube that form together for the male, and it creates a tube for the sperm to go down. It's called a gonopode. And he inserts this into the female, delivers the sperm, and then very gently rolls her back over and lays her down. She then goes to rest at the back of the den, and he then remains in the den, sort of standing guard while her new shell hardens and forms. And once she's ready and is strong again, and feels that she has enough protection to go out into the sea, she will leave his den and the next female will come, because the Maine lobster is a serial monogamist.
Wow.
Yeah.
All
so right. It's romantic and kinky.
Okay, so female lobsters have their virginity restored when they get this fresh new pouch. Some female species store sperm for a rainy day or a rainy year. They can carry this around for a long time before they actually make use of it.
This is right, yes. And we see this. Sharks are a great example. And they have shown through, especially in aquaria, where we know how long it's been since a female has made it, it's up to 4 years that they can store this sperm.
Wow. And that's simply because it might be hard to find a mate, or they like who they've found and they want to... I mean, biologically, they find a preference to create offspring with that sperm.
Right. So there's several different theories. And again, this is all part of some of the work known as female cryptic choice, which is a fancy way of saying the hidden ways that females are controlling the outcome of sex after sex has happened. Hmm. And so there's different thoughts on why this might be. So one potential is that when, especially say in sharks, females and males often live in different environments. And some of this has to do with their reproduction. So females might need warmer, more food supplies, warmer areas and more food supplies while they're pregnant. And so they'll live separately, say, than the males do. And they only come across males at certain times of year. But those might not be the best time of year for them to get pregnant and actually bear the energy burden of pregnancy. So they will mate with the male, store that sperm, and then when the season is right or her physical fitness and condition is right, she'll then draw upon that sperm store to create her offspring and move forward with the pregnancy.
Marine biologist Mara J. Hart is my guest this hour. She's research co-director for the nonprofit Future of Fish. We're talking about her book, Sex in the Sea, Our Intimate Connection with Sex-Changing Fish, Romantic Lobsters, Kinky Squid, and Other Salty Erotica of the Deep. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now to design your own doctoral or master's degree at SMU, specializing in organizational dynamics, human rights, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
My guest is Mara J. Hart. This is Think on KERA. She is research co-director for the nonprofit Future of Fish and author of a new book called Sex in the Sea. Mara, I just imagine that like songs like that are on your playlist whenever you're working out or, you know, running into the lab.
You've got a great soundtrack going. It's wonderful.
So I wanted to ask you about this. There is a lot of sex changing in the ocean among creatures. What conditions would cause a certain number of fish in a school where ostensibly there are a lot of individuals to switch teams?
It's a great question. There's lots of different ways that different species are cued to change sex. And in some, it seems that they can just through social behavior or other cues that we're still trying to figure out, they have a very good sense of the sex ratio. So there are some species where experiments have been done where you remove, say, you know, 5 or 6 males from a reef where there's a bunch of fish swimming around, and 5 or 6 females will transition into male and make up for that sort of loss. In other species, it's a little bit more direct. It's through social cues that are happening in a close coordination. So in a harem, for example, many, many species of wrasse or, say, parrotfish. Parrotfish are a great example. They sex change from female to male, and the males sort of lord over a harem of females. And normally when that male then either dies or is eaten, you know, one way or another disappears, the female that is the largest female, the next sort of dominant one in the group, she will transition into male. But this doesn't always happen. And there's some really neat studies that are being done. The bucktooth parrotfish is one example where as fish get bigger, it's a little bit different than us, but as fish get bigger, they can carry more eggs. So with humans, when we're born, females are born with the total number of eggs we will ever have, and then it decreases over time. But in fish, the larger they grow, the more and more eggs they can produce. And we call these big mama fish boffs. So it's big, old, fat, fecund female fish. And they carry exponentially more eggs. So if you double the size of the female, she can often carry 10 times more eggs, for example. So we see in the bucktooth parrotfish this really funny sort of situation where the biggest female does not always transition to male when the leader, that lead harem master, disappears. Instead, she sort of does this bit of calculating where she'll look and she'll say, okay, based on the size of these other females in the harem and how many eggs they're likely producing, do I have more or less eggs than all of them combined? And if she has and is producing more eggs than all of the other females, it actually benefits her to stay female because she then can have the next in line female transition to male. And even small males have enough sperm to fertilize all the eggs of a big female. But if she were to transition, she'd become the male and only have the total number of eggs of all the other females combined. And in some cases, that's less than what one big female fish can produce. So sex change, it's not always as direct. It's not always cued in the way that we think it would. But most often it's social cues and has to do with dominance and the ability to know that at this point in time, I can change sex and gain a reproductive benefit, either take over a harem or keep the eggs that I have and have somebody else turn to male so that they can fertilize all my eggs.
It's really astonishing, Mara, and it also has implications for what we pull out of the ocean to eat, right? I mean, you'd think that you want the biggest, fattest female fish, but you could really do some damage by taking the largest ones among them.
That's true. And so sex change adds this layer of complexity when we're thinking about how we impact ocean species, because now not only do we have to be concerned with how many fish we're taking out of a population, but we also have to make sure that we're not skewing the sex ratio. And when we fish, we tend to be size specific, you know, the size of the hook or the way that we fish. We often target the biggest fish. And like you said, if we're targeting a species where those are all the females or those are all the males, we're going to wind up skewing that sex ratio and can really start to decrease the amount of reproduction happening and the amount of successful sex happening more than just because we're lowering the numbers. So there have been cases, the red hind is one example, and they've fished the species really hard and the numbers tanked, but the sex ratio also really got screwed. So the females who were left couldn't find a mate as easily. And that reduces, you know, the reproductive output as well.
All right. I want to talk about shark babies. This is not exactly sex, but they're the product of shark sex. And they need to watch their backs, even in utero.
Oh my, this is one of the, you know, this comes with a warning. This is a little bit of a freaky example, but yes. So sand tiger sharks have this fantastic reproductive strategy where the females have two uteri, one uterus on each side, and from each uterus comes only one pup. But she, the female, will become pregnant with multiple pups. And those embryos, the multiple embryos, the biggest one in each uterus will eat its siblings before they're born. So it's intrauterine cannibalism.
Wow.
And it's pretty gruesome. And it also sets up conditions for some massive sperm competition on the side of the males. Because what it means is that these males who are sending their sperm up into the females to try to fertilize her eggs, they're not getting a chance at just a couple of eggs. They're only getting a chance at one. They're racing to be the first male to be able to get to that biggest egg that can fertilize the embryo that's going to win the battle. So this, again, is an example of potentially this female cryptic choice, where inside the female, there's more competition and more going on than meets the eye in terms of who's actually going to father her offspring.
It's like Powerball. You have to get the right combination, and then you have to get the magic number, right?
That's right. And so what we think, and again, this is all in development, is we see that the males produce absolutely, in these species, in sand tiger sharks, the males produce copious amounts of sperm. I mean, just huge bucket loads of sperm. And it's likely that they're trying to flush, you know, her female tract. But probably, or possibly, what happens is that the female will mate first with one male. And we found through, this is some of the work that Dr. Damian Chapman out of Stony Brook University has developed in recent years. He's used genetic tests and has found that more often than not, the two pups that are born, one from each uterus, are actually from the same father. So even though she is mating with multiple males, only one is actually fertilizing these twins. They're in each uterus, but they're siblings, full siblings. And so what happens is the female, and in shark sex, it's pretty rough. The female can get pretty beaten up. And so, but avoiding and trying to avoid an encounter can also be pretty dangerous and energy intensive. So what could be happening, and again, this is a bit of speculation, but it could be that the female makes sure that she mates with a strong, good mate first, this male that she wants to fertilize her pups. Those two eggs are then fertilized, one in each uterus, and start to grow. Then she releases the next batch of eggs and will take the matings and advances of any other males that come by without having to worry that those males are actually going to sort of taint the genetic pool of her offspring, right? She can mate with them and they can fertilize the other eggs because ultimately those developing embryos are just food for her firstborn. So it's pretty gruesome, but it may be a way to help her have to avoid the costs of trying to avoid unwanted advances or having to have tough time, warding off these other males.
So sharks are tricky because they're definitely fish. They're not mammals, but they give birth to live young. But are those sand tiger sharks, once they're born, are those pups inclined to continue trying to eat their sibling, or are they like, oh, I'm over it now?
Well, so they kill them all in uterus.
But after those two pups
are born. Oh, after they're born? No, they're born. They're huge when they're born. Mm-hmm. So they kind of just swim off. It's sort of like they come out of the mom and boom, they're gone to go hunt something. Their sibling would be quite large for them to attack at that point because they're equal in size. So instead, they'll now go off and hunt fish and other things. It's really just their housemates, that their roommates in the womb that they go after.
Is noise pollution a problem in the oceans?
Yes, it is. And this goes back to some of what we were talking about at the beginning in terms of search tactics and ways to seduce mates. And we were talking about the blue whales. So sound is incredibly important for many species. They rely on it to not only find their mates, but to communicate across the area, to navigate when it comes down to whales. And we have made the oceans a much noisier place. It's through oil and gas exploration, through naval sonar activities, through ship traffic. And by increasing the noise levels, it's basically creating this this overlying, you know, fog through which these animals have to try to find one another. And the analogy I make is for all of us who, you know, look at online dating platforms, right? The larger the area, the larger the geography that you can choose from. If you have an international dating platform, the greater the chances you're going to find somebody who's your fit, right? It's a bigger pool. And we've basically restricted through sound pollution whales to having a Match.com equivalent of just their hometown, right? They can't sort of hear beyond this much smaller range in order to try to figure out what mates are out there for them. And that's very limiting and could have some pretty significant consequences on their capacity to have successful sex.
So some people out there might actually be fishermen, fisher people, but a lot of people consume fish that they've purchased at the store or at a restaurant. Is there anything we absolutely, Maura, never should be eating that comes from the ocean?
That's a really good question. And I always try to be have perspective in this. But the one thing that I took away from doing all of this research is we should never be eating animals who were taken during their spawning season. So it's not that we can never eat a certain species. I do have my list of species that I personally would not eat until I know that the management is a little bit stronger and better. But in terms of just thinking about creating sex-friendly seafood habits, we really want to allow fish and shrimp and, you know, lobsters to be able to reproduce. And many management regimes do this. So I know, you know, off the East Coast, you have to put lobsters back if you catch a female, or a female certainly with eggs. And things like that, management awareness is there in that regard. But there are so many species that are still right now fished on their spawning aggregations worldwide. And so these are, you know, things like grouper and jacks and snappers that get together only once a year to reproduce. And all of the adults in the breeding population are in one place at one time just to get that job done. And we come in and fish. And we take out many, many individuals, often too many, because it's very easy to do because there's so many there. And we're disrupting the behaviors that will allow them to sort of complete the act, so to speak. So there's likely lots of social cues and some social hierarchy that's being established so that the females know who to pair up with, or that these group spawn activities can be coordinated. And when you drop some fishing gear, you know, through that business, it can be very disruptive. So I would say one of the first and best things that we can all do is just to let these animals spawn in peace and fish them afterwards. Because then what we're doing is allowing them to reproduce, and we will all benefit from having that next generation on the way to repopulate the reefs as things go on.
And when in doubt, ask for farmed fish?
Yeah, so farm fish is a great alternative. And like wild fish, there is farm fish that's farmed responsibly and then farm fish that's not so great. So I encourage everyone, the Monterey Bay Seafood Watch program is a great guide to species both in the wild and farmed for those who are looking to try to be a little bit more environmentally responsible. But also, you know, local fish, U.S. management is fantastic. You know, we have really strong management that's in place to try to protect these species. So going local and trying to go in season is a wonderful way to help, you know, ensure that we have a future full of fish and successful reproduction in the sea.
Maura J. Hart is Research Co-Director for Future of Fish and author of Sex in the Sea, Our Intimate Connection with Sex-Changing Fish, Romantic Lobsters, Kinky Squid, and Other Salty Erotica of the Deep. Maura, thank you so much for making time for us.
Thanks so much for having me. This was a blast.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phones from Kristen Taylor. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.